This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. Every 10 years following the census, when the country counts itself, the states are required to redraw their legislative districts. Under the control of Republicans who won the legislature in 2010, the North Carolina General Assembly redrew the state's maps. And now, 5 years later, a challenge to North Carolina's congressional maps was heard in the Supreme Court of the United States, with the state legislative districts forced back to the drawing boards based on a federal court ruling. In both cases, the question about these maps has become, were they drawn in such a way as to violate the U.S. Constitution? Did race play a role in drawing these maps? And if it was politics that played a role, how political can gerrymandering be in benefiting one party over the other? This morning, we'll attempt to answer the questions with individuals who have been following these developments. In studio is Michael Tomczyk, WFAE reporter. He's been covering redistricting in the state and reported this week on the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. Good morning. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Michael.
And joining us by phone is a scholar who literally wrote a book on redistricting. Dr. Charles S. Bullock III holds the Richard B. Russell Chair in Political Science and is the Josiah Meigs Distinguished Teaching Professor and University Professor at the University of Georgia. He is the author of many books on Southern politics and voting rights and wrote the book Redistricting, the Most Political Activity in America. Good morning, Dr. Bullock.
Morning, Michael. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Later in the show, we'll have two members of the North Carolina General Assembly, one who chairs the House Redistricting Committee and one who is proposing a different way to independently approach redistricting. If you'd like to join the conversation and the discussion on redistricting or have a question on gerrymandering, send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet at charlottetalks. Dr. Bullock, I want to start with you. In your book, you called redistricting the most political activity in America. Why is that, and how exactly can we understand what redistricting is?
Yeah, it's so political because the maps that get drawn at the beginning of a decade, unless challenged, they've been here, will last for 10 years. And if you draw the maps carefully enough, then your party, if you're in the majority, will probably be able to hold control of that legislative chamber or, in the case of congressional delegation, the delegation for the next 10 years. Now, it's not surprising, therefore, that the party that loses in the legislature pretty regularly now goes to court and tries to find some grounds on which to overturn the plan that was put into effect by the legislature. So, during the minority, you try to get a second turn at that.
Okay. Michael, you've been following the redistricting saga here in North Carolina, and just within the past week, we've had both the state House and state Senate districts and the congressional districts in federal court. Give us an update on where things stand here in North Carolina.
Sure. So there have been two different federal three-judge panels that struck down either the congressional districts or the state House and Senate districts, so the state legislative districts. And the biggest updates on those are that the case where the state House and Senate districts were struck down, and both were struck down as racial gerrymanders. In the state legislative districts case, there's now there's been a ruling that says that the legislature needs to redraw those by March and then hold a new election in November, which obviously would mean that all the folks who were just elected last month are only going to be serving a one-year term. State lawmakers have requested a hold on that so that they could try to get this case up to the Supreme Court to be settled. Now, the other case, the one that involves our congressional district, so who we send to Congress, that was actually before the Supreme Court on Monday, and it was, by my count, the seventh time the U.S. Supreme Court has heard arguments over a North Carolina redistricting case.
So, Dr. Bullock, we have a history here in North Carolina of making it to the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to redistricting cases?
Absolutely, yeah. Congressional districts that were drawn in 1991 paid four visits to the Supreme Court, which is remarkable. And this, remember, was what was called the I-85 district, a very narrow, long district, District 12. It went from Charlotte all the way up to Durham. And it was in that case that the Supreme Court for the first time said, wait a minute, you know, that looks so strange, and it looks like race is maybe being used here to separate voters. takes another case, a case out of Georgia, Miller v. Johnson, really clarifies it. But in that Miller v. Johnson case, the Supreme Court essentially said when you start segregating voters on the basis of race, putting whites in one district, blacks in another district, that's akin to what used to be done with regard to schools where children were separated. And if you do that, the court said, then you're violating the Equal Protection Clause. So that was really where this all begins, and what's playing out now is refinements along those same kinds of concerns about separating voters by race. Now, there was the 2000 case, again, out of North Carolina, the Comity case, which the Supreme Court said, well, if you're making these separations and you're doing the basis of party, so you're putting Democrats in one area and Republicans in another one, and even though an awful lot of those Democrats are probably African Americans, court seemed to say, we're not going to look too deeply beyond that. So as long as the discussion in the legislature emphasizes party and not race, then you're probably going to be good to go.
So let me step back. In the 1990s, what caused North Carolina to have to draw the 12th congressional district? Those folks who live here in Mecklenburg County and in Charlotte have a long history with understanding the 12th congressional district. I think at one point it started west of Charlotte in Gastonia and it ended up right in Durham. As you said, it kind of snaked along I-85. Where did the reasoning come for having that district as what some have defined it as a majority-minority district?
Right, okay, so peeling the onion a little bit deeper. that goes back to the 1982 amendments to the Voting Rights Act, which rewrote Section 2 and made it a factor. So in the early 1990s, the Department of Justice in North Carolina was among those states that had to get approval either by the Department of Justice or the District Court of the District of Columbia for any new redistricting plans. When they sent their plans to the Department of Justice, North Carolina had not had an effective majority black district in decades. And the state had drawn one there in the early 1990s over in the eastern part of the state, the first district, and probably thought that they were, you know, ahead of the game, that they'd created a majority black district where there hadn't been one. The Department of Justice, using this Section 2, which the Justice Department at that point was interpreting to require jurisdictions to kind of maximize the number of minority districts, looked at North Carolina and said, no, we think you could actually draw a second majority black district. And so that stopped the plan that the state legislature had adopted. They went back to the drawing board. And because North Carolina does not have a huge concentration of African Americans in a single urban area like Atlanta does or Houston or Chicago or New York, the way that second majority black district was done was to run along the interstate so that you weren't picking up any people at all, essentially, in parts, and connect the black concentrations in Charlotte and Winston-Salem and Greensboro and High Point and Durham. And once you strung those together like beads on a string, then you did have a majority black district. And this was done, as I say, to satisfy the Department of Justice, which had to sign off before a plan could be put in effect.
Okay. Michael.
And to kind of link where that meets the politics of these things, so it used to be in the 90s when these other North Carolina cases have made it up there, there were times where Democrats drawing these lines had theirs struck down, essentially for being too focused on race.
So this has been a bipartisan issue.
Exactly. But whereas now the argument has changed to, okay, we need to create these, to the arguments you hear now are whether Republican lawmakers who are drawing them are using these as a way to pack even more Democratic voters into a few districts, which then make the surrounding districts easier to win. And the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday out of this North Carolina case, Justice Stephen Breyer kind of walked out some of this history and talked about how basically, I'll read a quote here. He says, and the problem is, how does the law permit the creation of that, meaning the majority-minority districts, and at the same time prevent the kind of packing that might appear in other cases, which is gerrymandering? And Justice Breyer said, quote, no one, I think, has a good answer to that question. There is just slightly better, slightly worse.
So, Dr. Bullock, is it this in the eye of the beholder kind of test that the Supreme Court is looking at when it comes to race and the drawing of these districts? Is it really just, have they ever been clear in terms of this percentage is acceptable and this percentage isn't?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court has never done that. Now, lower courts have had different standards in time. Now, if you go back to the 1980s, A number of federal judges were saying you had to draw a district that was going to be at least 65% black in total population for it to be effective, and there were decisions which came out of doing that. Then once you get to the implementation of Section 2, when the court first deals with that, and against the North Carolina case, the Thornburg versus Jingles case, the court came up with three standards for that. And the first one was, is the minority population sufficiently large and concentrated that it could form a district? So coming off of that is the idea that the district needs to have a majority black, and not just a majority black, but majority black voting age citizens is kind of what that's evolved to. So that would set the 50% of the adult citizens being minority as a threshold.
Okay. And so here in North Carolina, there seems to be certain rules that the state legislature has to abide by in terms of redrawing and redistricting these districts. The first one is one person must equal one vote. But then the next two are the consideration of minorities, but the impermissible consideration of race. Can you And I guess, Michael, maybe I'll start with you. Can you really dissect or divorce race from politics, particularly here in North Carolina?
That is the central question that is the reason our cases have made it to the U.S. Supreme Court so often. Even the justices in the arguments on Monday, there were a couple different moments where, again, Justice Breyer, who has written some of these precedents, mm-hmm. admitted that, okay, clearly lower courts are having a hard time applying these standards that we've tried to create. And essentially the reason is, at least in North Carolina, the data show that I believe it's over 90% of African Americans tend to vote Democratic. So if you're looking to move Democrats one way or the other, as you had mentioned earlier, Michael, that sorting is going to naturally collect a lot of African Americans. Where the rubber meets the road is then, can you delineate, were they just looking to move Democrats, which is okay, you can do this for partisan reasons, or were they looking to move African Americans? And now the Senator Rucho and Representative Lewis, two of the folks who were behind the 2010 redrawing, at least Senator Rucho, he often would tell me when I was doing these stories, like, look, we drew these maps to meet the Voting Rights Act. I mean, he clearly felt that he was following the standard that had been set up. And now, you know, a couple years later, as this thing has moved along and there's been more clarity in a different case out of Alabama from the U.S. Supreme Court, in some ways, the folks that I talk to make it sound like it just feels like a moving target to try to figure out if you are navigating that politics versus race line accurately.
Dr. Bullock, are other states experiencing the same thing? Is North Carolina unique in that, or are they experiencing this kind of shifting line when it comes to race and politics?
Yeah, there was the same day as the North Carolina hearing, also a hearing on a case out of Virginia. So Virginia and North Carolina, the two that are the cutting edge of this, if the Supreme Court were to find in favor of the plaintiffs in these cases, I'd expect to see a number of other states being sued with similar kinds of issues being raised.
Okay.
One of them, I don't know what I suggest here too, a new term, non-retrogression. And that was a standard that was always applied for Section 5. And what that meant was, once a minority district reached a certain percentage concentration of minorities, if you dial that back in your redistricting plan...
We're going to have to pick that up after the break, Dr. Bullock. We'll be right back. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and High Point University's Access to Innovators series featuring Dr. Nito Quabane's conversation with Dr. Carol Dweck, airing tonight at 10 p.m. on UNC TV. More information at highpoint.edu. And from Carolina's healthcare systems, HealthWorks, working with employers to improve the bottom line through innovative employee health solutions. carolinashealthcare.org/healthworks. On the local news roundup, a month after Election Day, the North Carolina governor's race ends with Roy Cooper headed to the executive mansion. Pat McCrory conceded defeat, then met with President-elect Donald Trump. Is there a spot for McCrory in the new administration? Jennifer Roberts could face a Democratic challenger for Charlotte mayor. The county commission chairman is unseated. A mistrial of the North Charleston police shooting, while the Charleston church shooting trial begins across the street. Those stories and more with guest host Eric Spanberg and a roundtable of reporters when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the son of Donald Trump's pick for national security advisor has resigned for spreading a fake news story that led to an armed confrontation at a D.C. restaurant. The danger of fake news and how to combat it.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE 90.7 and 90.3 WFHE in Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about redistricting and gerrymandering. My apologies to Dr. Bullock for having to cut him off. You were talking about the role of African-American voters in redistricting, and you were mentioning the notion of retrogression. Can you clarify and continue on with your thoughts on that?
Right, yeah. So states like North Carolina that had to get their plans approved by the federal government, the standard used to assess whether a new plan was fair was non-retrogression. And the idea was that if minorities constitute a certain share of a district, say 54% already, you couldn't get a new plan approved if you reduced that percentage. You could go up, so it could ratchet up, but it couldn't go back. And my thought is probably that the North Carolina legislators, as they were looking at their obligations to avoid violating the Voting Rights Act, had this very much in their minds. They didn't want to reduce concentrations, fearing that if they did so, the plan would be rejected.
Okay. Paul emailed, why is political gerrymandering permitted, and doesn't that also violate the equal protection of the U.S. Constitution? And Dr. Bullock, I know that there was a recent case out of Wisconsin where a federal judge panel, three-judge panel, said that in Wisconsin, the Republicans had drawn the lines to make it impossible for Democrats to receive their share of power. And in fact, they quoted that the secure Republican control of the assembly under any likely future electoral scenario for the remainder of the decade, in other words, to entrench the Republican Party in power. We've talked about race. How does the court, or how has the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the role of politics and partisanship in terms of redistricting?
Well, until 1986, if you raised a redistricting claim based upon partisan unfairness, the court would say, yeah, what do you expect? If your party was in the majority, you'd do the same thing to the other party.
So to the victors go the spoils?
Exactly right. Now,
okay.
In 86, the court said, well, okay, that now is at least something we will look at. Part of that, they wouldn't even look at it. In the 30 years since then, the Supreme Court has never come across a case where it found that partisan gerrymandering was so extreme that they were willing to overturn a district. Now, this experience with the three-judge court in Wisconsin, I would think would certainly be appealed, and we'll see if the Supreme Court's willing to do anything. The last time the Supreme Court dealt with this was about 10 years ago in a case out of Pennsylvania, and the plan was upheld by a 5-4 vote. Four of the justices, led by Justice Scalia, said he thought that they'd gotten it wrong back in 86, and he wanted to again make a partisan claim something that courts wouldn't look at. Swing Justice, Justice Kennedy, who voted with the four in the minority, say, well, no, let's keep this alive as a issue, although Kennedy did not think the proof had been sufficient in that case. So no one has ever won a case based upon a partisan claim when it's gotten to the Supreme Court.
Michael.
And that's something that is really shocking to people who do not cover this.
Why?
Whenever I'm just the idea that it is perfectly okay for you to draw the lines in a way where it doesn't, it has nothing to do with how many total Republican or Democratic votes there are in the state. It is purely about trying to win as many seats for your party as you can. But again, with the American separation of powers, we have this tradition of courts trying not to answer what they see as political questions. And, there's plenty of debate as to how good of a job or not courts are doing with that. But at least with redistricting, exactly as Dr. Bullock just explained, there has yet to be a case where the U.S. Supreme Court has struck something down for political reasons.
Dr. Bullock, a lot of folks have said that redistricting has become an exercise in gerrymandering, that political parties can basically buy themselves insurance policies to protect themselves and protect their majority status. Many also attribute the polarization of our politics to redistricting. Do you see that as the case?
You know, that's a hard case to make, that all of our polarization is due to redistricting. And the reason for that is that the U.S. Senate is probably as polarized as the U.S. House is. And, you know, you don't draw districts for senators. So, yes, there may be some contribution that redistricting makes to polarization within the U.S. House, but there's also something in the air out there which is infecting our politics in other ways rather than just redistricting alone.
Okay. And how do other states here in North Carolina, the legislature has complete control over the redistricting process. The governor has no say. How do other states handle redistricting, Dr. Bullock?
Well, in most states, the governor would have a veto. So North Carolina is, if not unique, rare in not letting the governor intercede in that. You have a growing number of states, and California is one of the recent ones to join this, which have taken the whole process out of the hands of the legislature and put it in the hands of the commission. There was a challenge to using commissions that came out of Arizona, and the courts upheld that, so that's an acceptable alternative. And there are various ways that people get appointed to commissions. In some states, Democrats appoint half, Republicans appoint half, and then they could have those on the commission choose a chair. That's what they do in New Jersey. In other states like California and Arizona, there's a real attempt made to divorce the selection process for those who are going to be on the commission from partisan politics. And that's certainly not the majority approach, but mm-hmm. it's growing in popularity.
Do we find that with those commissions, that partisanship does, that the districts do become more competitive instead of slanted towards one party over the other?
Yeah, there is some more competitiveness in under those plans. That certainly doesn't mean that every district is going to be competitive,
right.
But you'll have some that are. And I don't know about North Carolina, but in Georgia right now, none of our congressional districts are competitive at all.
Okay. We've got an email from Dennis who writes in, I think I've read that some states actually just draw districts based on population. Each district's population is roughly the same without regard to political affiliation or race. Is that true? That approach seems to me the best way to eliminate representatives picking their voters. I think voters should pick their representatives. Do we hear that, Michael? Do we hear that complaint often that instead of the voters picking the elected officials, it's actually the elected officials picking their voters?
From every person that I talk to who takes time to learn about how this stuff actually works, yes. Mm-hmm. But the thing about redistricting is I think to some degree it flies under the radar. It's so technical. It's so confusing. There just is, in general, not as much outrage about this topic as there is about a lot of other topics in government.
Well, we've certainly got one individual who is prosecuting the case for an independent commission here in North Carolina, Senator Jeff Jackson, Democratic state senator from Mecklenburg in District 37, joins us. Good morning, Senator.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. And by phone, we also have Representative David Lewis, who is a Republican state representative for Hartnett County in District 53, first elected in 2002. He serves as the chairman of the House Redistricting Committee and was one of the instrumental individuals to oversee the maps that are now being contested. Good morning, Representative Lewis.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. Both of you have been hearing the conversation that we've been having this morning. Representative Lewis, let me start with you because the Republicans are in power. They did draw the maps as currently are being challenged in court. How did the Republicans go about drawing the maps back in 2011? And what is your perspective on the court challenges so far?
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on this. I do think it's important to frame this that in 2011, we made very clear the criteria that we were using in drawing the legislative maps. And folks sometimes get confused between the legislative and the congressional maps. So let's talk about the legislative maps first. What we did is we adhered to the one person, one vote standard, which I think everybody would agree is required by law. Doesn't seem like a particularly partisan thing to think that every district should have the same number of people in it so that everybody's vote counts the same. We then looked to the requirements of the Federal Voting Rights Act, which basically say in a nutshell that if there's a compact enough minority population which can be identified, that they should have the opportunity to participate and elect a candidate of their choice We then complied with the requirements of the state courts in their Stevenson decisions, which have to do with the size of the districts and trying to keep counties whole and grouping as few counties together as you can in order to make seats. And also the Strickland provision, which came in 2009, which defined truly what a minority-majority district was. So the criteria that we applied was the criteria that we understood to be the law. We held over 36 public hearings. We had the most open and transparent process ever before. We asked people to participate. We empowered the Democratic caucus to hire their own staff and to draw their own maps. We provided staff and a budget even for the Black caucus in the General Assembly to hire their own staff and to fully engage and participate in this process. What we got was largely nothing. No maps were produced by anyone else until the very day of the vote. There was no effort to participate. Instead, what we had is what we've had for 4 years now, which is just the threat that we'll see you in court. It's our job to litigate this, and that's where we are now. I will speak briefly, if I may, on the congressional district. I heard Dr. Bullock talking about the 12th congressional district. Let me be clear. I don't like the way the 12th is drawn. The 12th was drawn and litigated for more than 30 years, upheld by the United States Supreme Court on two separate occasions as a strong Democratic district. It was drawn as a political gerrymander by the Democrats, and to be candid with you, we were afraid to mess with it. That's why it looks the same way it did when it was first drawn in the 1990s. So we did the best we could to comply with the law. I think we have. I think it's also fair to point out that a case was brought in state court. It's referred to as the Dixon versus Rucho. It went through a three-judge panel. They declared that the districts, legislative and congressional, were constitutional. It went to the North Carolina Supreme Court, who concurred. It's been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the case that was heard on Friday was, in fact, a second round of lawsuits that were filed. And I will point out that just as Dr. Bullock pointed out, that while the requirement for preclearance by the Justice Department is no longer there, when we drew these maps in 2011, the very first stop was that President Obama's Justice Department had to review and preclear these maps, which they did. So I would say that these maps have been through quite a bit of review. I'm proud of them. I think they're fair, legal, and in most cases, competitive.
Okay. Let me before I get to Senator Jackson, let me let Michael Tomczyk jump in here.
Just to add to that a little bit, yep. That was actually how many different cases on this have been sort of cooking.
Okay.
That was part of the arguments before the Supreme Court on Monday. Both Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Chief Justice John Roberts asked, you know, we happen to be looking at this case where they were struck down. What if we were instead reviewing the Supreme Court case that the state Supreme Court case that Representative Lewis just mentioned, where they were upheld? So even the justices are aware of how there are all these different cases that have been going through the works for North Carolina.
Okay. Senator Jackson, you're on the other side, the Democratic side. How have y'all viewed these congressional and state legislative districts?
Well, gerrymandering is the biggest problem in North Carolina. It is the root of so many of our other problems. And in order to solve a lot of those problems, you have to start with gerrymandering. No matter how bad you think gerrymandering is, I assure you it's actually worse. Let me bottom line that for you. Okay. We got 50 state senators. We have 120 people in the House. We have a total of 170 state legislators. 90% of us, at least 90%, cannot lose a general election. We are effectively invulnerable. 90% of us could endorse our opponents, could give our opponents all of our money, could participate in television debates with sock puppets and still win. There is nothing that we can do to lose. 90%. We just heard Representative Lewis say, he concluded his remarks by saying he thought most of these districts were competitive. There were only two races in the state Senate out of 50 that were even within 10 percentage points. And of our 13 congressional districts, none of them is competitive. None of our current incumbents can lose to the other party. Zero of the 13 in reality. We'll have people run. They'll have lawn signs. They'll raise money. That's all great. They are not going to lose. The only race any of us can lose is our primary. And of 170 of us, we all had our primaries this year. You know how many of us lost our primary? Zero. You can't get rid of us. It's destroying politics.
So, Dr. Bullock, in terms of this notion of competitiveness, do you see this play out also in other states, that gerrymandering has basically diluted or lessened the ability of these districts to be competitive, to have competitive elections for the voters?
Oh, very much so, yeah. And this goes back a number of years to the Burton Plan in California, which was, locked into place, all the Democrats, all the Republicans. So in some states, you end up with these bipartisan gerrymanders where the incumbents of both parties come together and agree that we're going to make it safe for everybody. So, yeah, this is pretty standard.
Okay. Representative Lewis, you had talked about, and Republicans have also, when they were drawing the maps back in 2011, talked about the districts were drawn fair and legal. And certainly we're getting the legal controversies and challenges with these court decisions. How would you define fair as part of that fair and legal?
Fair means that you go around, you hold 36 public hearings all across the state, from as far in the east as Hosky, which I went to four times myself, to as far in the west. I know we went beyond Charlotte. We went to Asheville. We sought input. It's important to understand, when you look at the districts that were drawn in 2011, you look at the congressional district. The Democratic Party has a majority registration advantage in 12 out of 13 of those. The Democratic nominee for Attorney General, Roy Cooper, in 2004, won in 12 out of 13 of those. The bigger problem that face the Democrats is that they can't get candidates that appeal to the voters to vote for them. We all know that being involved in politics is, in its essence, a political activity. And so it is disingenuous to say that it is anything other than that. Senator Jackson has been an advocate for various reforms. I had hoped to prove a point to us that he would have run as an unaffiliated candidate for the Senate to show how much he wants partisanship to get out of the General Assembly.
And we're going to pick that up after the break. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Voices' 62nd annual Singing Christmas Tree and the Singing Christmas Tree for Kids, presenting a winter wonderland of holiday music, puppets, dancing, and more, Saturday and Sunday at the Knight Theater. Tickets at carolinatix.org. And from Mille Lacs Jewelers, direct diamond importers at the Arboretum, dedicated to consumer protection, ethical business practices, and gemological knowledge. Information about financing options available at millelacsjewelers.com. The son of Donald Trump's choice for national security advisor has resigned for spreading a fake news story, which led to an armed confrontation at a D.C. restaurant over the weekend. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, the danger of fake news and how to combat it. Before the lights go out on Charlotte's Double Door Inn, Charlotte Talks wants to hear your stories about that venue, which has been around for decades. You can find details about reaching us on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Next time on The World, an Asian stereotype turned around in Korea. Expectant parents there hope and pray for the birth of a daughter.
it's really no use to have a boy.
The reasons may surprise you. Of course, Korean families still love their sons.
But I was so relieved that I don't have to have a second baby. I think I've got what I want.
Why parents want daughters in Korea. That's On the World.
This afternoon at 3 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
And we're back on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking with Representative David Lewis, a member of the North Carolina State House from District 53, who serves as chairman of the House Redistricting Committee, along with Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democratic state senator from Mecklenburg, District 37. And Senator Jackson, I want to give you a chance to respond to Representative Lewis. But you have called for an independent redistricting commission. Can you talk a little bit about what your plan might entail?
Well, sure. The basic idea is you take the pen out of the hands of the politician. And I got the idea from the current leadership of the General Assembly, virtually all of whom supported independent redistricting when they were in the minority. Now, here's the part where I hold my own party accountable, because while we were in the majority, not only did we engage in partisan gerrymandering, but we also took all of those good proposals that the Republicans gave us for independent redistricting, and we threw them all in the trash can, because we never thought we'd be out of power. Then 2010 comes along, and they take power, and all of a sudden, now we've got a major problem, because they're now testing the theoretical limits of how far you can take gerrymandering. So I show up in 2014. The very first thing I do as a new kid, I take one of those bills out of the trash can for independent redistricting, and I file it, because I don't want them to be able to quibble with my method, because there are a lot of different ways to do independent redistricting. Mm-hmm. About 15 states are doing it. They all have a slightly different form of how big the commission is. Is it 9? Is it 17? What all the procedures are. The basic idea here is anything is better than the system we have now. North Carolina has the worst case scenario. I would take monkeys throwing darts at a board over the system that we have right now, which allows the most powerful party, most powerful politicians rather, to entrench themselves to make sure that they can never lose. Before we went to break, Representative Lewis said the reason why the Republicans have a supermajority is because Democrats can't get enough votes. In 2012 in North Carolina, more people actually voted for Democrats than Republicans, and they were able to capture a supermajority. There's only one reason why that's the case, and it's because they have the power of the pen. If you draw the map, you really can control the outcome of the election. I know a lot of people don't believe that, but these consultants have sliced it up. For everyone listening right now, there is a score attached to you, and you don't know this, but that score is how willing or how probable it is that you're going to vote one way or the other. And they use all of that information to put that score together to draw the maps to make sure that your voice doesn't count.
Representative Lewis, in the past, both Republicans and Democrats, particularly in the House, co-sponsored a bill, I believe it was House Bill 92, that would have established a nonpartisan redistricting commission that would be made up of members of both political parties. It seemed like there was sufficient support, and in fact, in the past, from what press accounts relate, the current Speaker of the House, Tim Moore, and this current state Senate President Phil Berger both supported that kind of initiative. Will Republicans bring that back in terms of looking at the state legislative districts for next year?
It's important to understand that we have legal requirements that we have to follow. Anybody, any group that draws a district has to draw them to certain qualifications. There has to be, you know, the one person, one vote rule. There, you need to make them as compact as they can be, and so on. The truth is, it will get down to where there's very little discretion to be made anyway. All I'm trying to say, and all that many of us are trying to say, is that it would be easy. It is great for me to sit around and say that I think nonpartisan redistricting and the hand of God to reach down and provide these completely unbiased ways for folks to run for office, that somehow that's able to be done. But the bottom line is, all of us have deeply held beliefs. All of us have ways that we interpret the same thing. You may look at this. I may look at the sky today and say, well, it's a really off shade of blue. You may say, well, it looks gray. The bottom line is, all of our opinions will matter. I get told all the time, well, look at the states like Iowa. Iowa has an independent redistricting board. Iowa still had over 20% of their legislative races that went unchallenged this year. I get told, look at the legal cost of the of all these things. We need an independent redistricting board. In Arizona, they've got one. They've had over $3 million worth of legal bills this year alone. I say all that to say, I try to be honest and intellectually open with the people that vote for me to return to the General Assembly. I tell them that you cannot take politics out of what is essentially a political activity, which is the drawing of legislative districts.
Well, let me ask Dr. Bullock, would an independent, if you had the criteria that North Carolina is under, the one person, one vote, the issue of consideration of race, but not an over-consideration, the whole county provision that districts must be contiguous, is there a way, even with those factors and those requirements, to have a kind of independent and perhaps nonpartisan way of drawing the districts?
Well, you can certainly try to appoint a nonpartisan commission. You have to do an awful lot of vetting if you're going to try to make sure you eliminate anyone who has strong partisan ties. That's what they tried to do in California. Nonetheless, even there, after the fact, there were claims launched by Republicans that Democrats managed to infiltrate the process and that the actual panel was tilted Democratic. So, it is awfully difficult to eliminate this. I mean, I guess you could turn over to a bunch of academics and let them do it. But this has been tried sometimes in court, where they hired an outsider, brought them into a state. They didn't know anything about the state. They didn't pay any attention to partisanship or to incumbency. And when you do that, there are downsides to that, too, in that you often end up with an awful lot of them, at least initially, contests involving two or more incumbents having to run against each other. Yes, it gives you a great deal of competition, at least in that first round, but it may also sacrifice some institutional knowledge when you do that.
Okay. Linda emailed in, if we didn't record party affiliation for voters, would that help us draw less partisan districts, or are districts drawn based on precinct voting records? Senator Jackson, let me start with you on that issue regarding knowing what the voter is, how they are registered. Does that factor into the redistricting process, in your opinion?
It's a major factor. And if we were to take a look at how to actually do this fairly, we would take a serious look at the types of categories of information that map drawers would be allowed to have access to and wouldn't be allowed to have access to. And I think there would be a big conversation around partisan data. And look, I agree with Representative Lewis fundamentally that it is impossible to completely remove politics from this process. However, you could make a dramatic improvement over the status quo. I mean, no one can argue that basically having one or two politicians in the majority party completely control the experience and the map drawing experience and the map drawing outcome is not the worst case scenario from a partisan outcome. And from an ethical standpoint, I don't think anyone can defend the fact that 90% of us can't lose an election. That's not normal. It's not as if, as Representative Lewis indicates, that's the necessary outcome of the law. It is not. And the way that you know that's not the necessary outcome of the law is because they're opposed to independent redistricting. If they really thought that their map was the only one that they could legally draw, they would have no problem handing this over to an independent commission because that commission would produce the exact same map and then they could say, look, it wasn't us, it was them. But they're not giving it to a commission, even though they proposed it every single year in between 2002 and 2009, because they know what would happen. Fair maps would be drawn. They would lose a lot of seats because we're fundamentally a 50-50 state. And the split right now in the state Senate is 35-15, with 35 Republicans and 15 Democrats. And yet we just elected a Democratic governor, a Democratic attorney general. There's only one way you can have a 35-15 split and still elect Democrats statewide, and that is with intense, thorough rigging of all of the statewide elections through gerrymandering.
Representative Lewis?
So I think it's important to understand that, I mean, Senator Jackson is very much aware that while we did elect, the state did elect Governor-elect Cooper as a Democrat, they also elected the Republican nominee for president, the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate, the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor, the Republican nominee for treasurer, and so on. I still point out that the districts must be drawn. Our state must be subdivided into 170 different districts, as Senator Jackson points out. There are criteria to doing that, the same population in each one. I would argue, and I believe I could bear this out if given more time, I would argue that one of the reasons that incumbents are as successful in winning re-election as they are, one, is that they have a tremendous fundraising advantage over the challengers. Two, there is not, frankly, as much interest in getting involved in politics, which is a shame. That's something I think Senator Jackson and I could probably actually agree and work on, try to find ways to inspire and recruit more and more folks to get involved. The bottom line is this problem is not confined to North Carolina. It's not confined to maps that were drawn only by Republicans. This is a nationwide issue. Again, I point to Iowa, which has nonpartisan redistricting, in which one in five seats went unchallenged. The same rate of re-election is found nationwide, regardless of who draws the maps.
Dr. Bullock, Representative Lewis mentioned Iowa. It's kind of looked at as the model for this approach. Do you find, I don't know if you know much about Iowa politics, but do you find that there is competitiveness in the state of Iowa when it comes to the districts?
Well, I know, I've not looked at the state legislature, but when it comes to the congressional districts, yeah, it is complete upturning of the apple cart when they draw new plans, because they do not consider where incumbents live, and almost invariably the new plans will match up incumbents in one district, create another district nearby, which is an open district. Like North Carolina, they try to avoid splitting counties and generally avoid doing that, so they have a bit larger population deviation in a lot of states. But, yeah, it does produce greater competitiveness when you're not paying any attention to where incumbents are and trying to bolster them. Although it's also true that when it is done by partisan members, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, neither side comes in with clean hands.
Okay. Michael, I know you want to jump in here on the conversation. Let me ask this question that Tony emailed, because I think it points to a point that you made earlier in the show. Tony emailed, can you explain why it's considered acceptable to draw a district's lines according to political party? And I guess ultimately the courts have looked at that, and you talked about the issue of a political question.
Yeah, and so to answer that for Tony, essentially the justices have held over the decades that if it is a question that should be purely political, then that should be left to legislatures, because after all, if people don't like the answer to that question, they can vote them out of office. So for that reason, you've had things struck down for racial reasons, but not necessarily political reasons. But the other thing that I actually wanted to add just here as well is, you know, we're hearing all of these different arguments for or against it and how the maps were drawn. And these are the ones you generally hear in the public sphere. When you get into court, the arguments simplify dramatically. I will tell you exactly how the state defended Congressional District 12 mm-hmm. to the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday. Quote, with respect to Congressional District 12, this was avowedly a political draw. A bit later, the court's last and best word on cases like this, where the state says, why did we do it? Politics. They are completely upfront that that politics was the reason, trying to win their party more seats, because courts have said that's okay. So the conversation in court is a very, very different one from the one that we generally hear in more public forums like this.
Okay, Senator Jackson.
You know, he's right. They use this as a legal defense. I mean, Representative Lewis said on the floor of the state house, quote, I think electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats, so I drew this map in a way to help foster what I think is better for the country. And that ran in the New York Times. And that might actually, unbelievably, be legal. But it's wrong. I mean, this is a legal question, it's a political question, but it's fundamentally a moral question. And the good thing about gerrymandering, the good news here is that it brings everybody together, because virtually everybody who knows this issue is on the same side. Everyone is opposed to it. They understand that this is wrong. They understand it is bad for our democracy and ultimately bad for our families. It hurts us in any number of ways by preventing actual coalitions from being able to come together in a state that whose General Assembly actually represents the political will of that state. But the bad news is when you've got an issue that brings everybody together these days, that must mean that something really wrong is happening. And unfortunately, that's the case.
Representative Lewis, I want to give you a chance to address the moral question that Senator Jackson just raised about redistricting. Do you see it as a moral issue?
Absolutely. I think it's immoral to lie and say that you can somehow contain and control what is inherently a political process. I have made very clear that there are various factors that go into how the districts are drawn, and that in the end, if there is any discretion left, I want to be honest with my constituents and say that I will view it through the eyes of a Republican. Dr. Bullock mentioned the state of Iowa. I, of course, was talking more about the legislative districts, but Iowa's a great example. You've got a state that's geographically basically square that has four U.S. congressional seats. It's a lot easier to draw those seats than in a state like ours. So you've got to always factor those things in. You've got to consider the evidence in its entirety. We have to understand that no matter where a line is drawn, it will have political impact.
And that's Representative David Lewis, member of the North Carolina State House from District 53, Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democratic state senator from here in Mecklenburg, District 37, Dr. Charles Bullock from the University of Georgia, and Michael Tomczyk from WFAA News. We probably won't solve this in any time soon, but I appreciate the hour and your time. Thank you.
Thank you.